Welcome back, podcast listeners. Here we are once more on the Multipod podcast. Now we share with you our episode 17, in which we continue the conversation with our potty peep Charlotte Walters about community architecture. On episode 16, we talk about her Feminist Mentorship Gap project as an example of community design and community building. Now we take the conversation we left to talk about organic shapes for communities, leadership, and how communities relate to politics, among other things. By the end of our previous episode, we were talking about how to disrupt hierarchical structures, and that made me think about the shapes of communities. It comes to my mind the shape of the pyramid, right? When we talk about hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And thinking about this disruption, it makes me think of also disrupting this hierarchy is disrupting also the shape of the pyramid and make it more of a circle instead of a pyramid, in which people kind of can rotate roles and intersect between each other with different roles and not necessarily having a present leader. I guess you act in the form of a leader when you create these programs.
I think you're absolutely right. Like whenever I designed it as there's tiny circles and then there's bigger. It is a very circular pattern, but not circular inward like a spiral. That can create a certain sense of inertia, right? Just that kind of design by itself can create a vortex in itself. But it is very much a series, and it is actually, it's fun. It's really, really good observation because, yes, that's exactly like when I mapped it out very much as when I connected it, it was very much circular, right? But also I called it sort of like, it's like a molecular circular design at the same time. I can't really explain it because I'm not a very good artist. So my hand sketches are crude. But yes, I actually always envision a circle because it is a very, imposing and pretty in and of itself is not as functional long-term. And if you take the concept of the circular design, if it's rotating correctly and everything's moving correctly, it will self-perpetuate. Now there is no leader. While I create the programs, I create them for another organization or another group, and depending on how their needs are, like sometimes there is a requirement that there needs to be some sort of accountability, and if you want to take the accountability as being shape of a leader. That's one thing. But in the case of, let's go back to the example we've been discussing, which is the Women's Legal Mentorship Program. I created it, and actually they have chapter leadership, but the way they're actually job descriptions, their leadership, they're given leadership descriptions. They're very functional. They're not just like, it's functional. You must get, it's no different than working in a corporation or working in a law firm or any kind of job you have your job description. So given it has to meet people with different experience levels, because not the one thing by people have asked me, well, why did you build in this female leadership function? Because the reality is in this particular field, quite a few of the young women stepping into these positions don't have the opportunity to lead. All right. So let's give them some leadership, a taste of leadership opportunity at an early level to learn how to make mistakes, frankly, and make success. Because I learn more from failure than I do success sometimes. And so that's part of the reason why I have the actual users of the product take leadership of the product, too, if you want to look at it that way, if you want to look at it a program product way. So one of the things they actually, the way I drafted all their descriptions is they're all integrated. And whenever I or someone else who supports the program through the mentorship for support services or whatever the program's function is, and they do the orientation, one of the first things you do is you actually highlight whose jobs, where you overlap. So no one person is responsible for one singular thing. You can't have any silo building. And we purposely, when I've actually done orientation, I purposely show the leadership team where their activities overlap, and I make sure they understand why their leadership activities overlap the way they do for success.
Hmm.
So they really, because everybody can, like, you know, I'm sure many people who listen to the podcast can actually understand or have memories of, you're in a group meeting with a manager or something, and say, they have that horrible saying, there is no I in team, we're a team. And you're thinking back there, like, no, we're not, because person X does not do, you're not. You're thinking person X is not doing Y, which you're supposed to do. I'm doing this. No one's doing that. And so you're in a team environment that talks about creating a team, but you feel like you're a team of one. So one of the things that I felt really strongly about is when creating this micro mentorship community for the Women's Legal Mentorship Program for female law students, is creating an integrated leadership system and making sure they understood it from the beginning. Now, that does not guarantee at all success of leadership, because there's lots of things that come down, like personality conflict sometimes happens, stress happens, things happen. Sometimes you get a mix. No matter how vigilant you've done, no matter how good the due diligence. And as I said, I don't oversee their ins and outs. I created the program. It's up to actually the law school's faculty advisors oversee any interpersonal issues. So, but I sometimes have, like, in the early years when I was actually part of the leadership team, and I was, you know, doing the beta testing of this as being part, actually being the chapter leader and seeing, okay, how many hours does it actually take to do these tasks? Like, being very, very specific about their tasks and how many hours a week it takes of volunteer work and things like that. I got to see, you know, it's just like any other leadership team. You get to see the good, bad, and the ugly. And the thing is, it's really a valuable experience at that level. And one of the reasons I wanted to have a user leadership experience as a critical part of the success of the program, is I wanted a place where women could make mistakes before they mattered. Because when you make mistakes people are like, how dare you make mistakes in law school? Like, let's keep this in perspective. Mm. This is not some movie where you have a law student saving the day or television shows. No. That never happens.
And the school is supposed to be a safety net.
Exactly.
To save you for that.
But you have to have an environment. You have to be able to be allowed to fail. You have to be able to and to be quite frank, when, you know, majority of law students are in their 20s, depending on their environment, this is the first time they failed and they take it badly, right? But that's why you have a support system. That's why you give them solid orientation. Now, you can't guarantee, and it's up to the law school and the faculty advisors to ensure. And they do. And that's, they've always had strong faculty advisors. So when, for instance, a lot of the female chapter chair leaders have gone on to be very successful lawyers, and quite a few of them, because we have, the leadership teams are very small, there's about 8 or 9 per year. Mm-hmm. And some years they repeat. And part of the thing is, if they're a returning student, they're entering their last year of law school, they are tasked with having a co-leader. So they train them to take over their position eventually. So there's that mentor, it's built in. That co-leading, that mentorship, that community leading is built in when it works perfectly. And so quite a few of the past chapter chair at the University of Ottawa for the last year, which was 2017, 2018, had impressed me incredibly. She stepped into a situation where had been massive failure. She lifted it up. This was after her first year. She lifted it up. She sorted out. She pulled together and really lived the philosophy. And because of her, over 2 years, it even strengthened and got back to the roots. Because I'm very interested in watching the failure as well. And so if something, a good community, and when you build, you can, it's like anything else. Any product, any program, any community is only as good as the members in it. But at the same time, you can't guarantee the members will always, you know, if they don't live the essence of the community, or they don't use the product well, you don't use the program correctly, there's nothing you can do. there's only so much. It's like having a piece of exercise equipment, you know. If your purpose of that exercise equipment was, you know, to get into shape, and you use it well for a month, but then it's in the corner for like a year, and you're wondering, why am I not more fit than when I bought that piece of equipment? It's the failure is not on the equipment, it's failure on the lack of your engagement with that equipment in order to succeed, right? So, for instance, the one particular young female leader I'm thinking of, she's applied to clerk at federal court level, and also she managed to, she was involved in so many leadership activities and pro bono work while she was also doing this. And also she, in Canada, they have to article, which is a little different from different parts of the, so you have to do a year of articling. It's like a co-op thing, but year of articling after you do your bar exam or before you do your bar exam and before you do what we call the call to the bar. And so, and then you become a lawyer. So she even, her leadership and all her skill, that exposure and her actually developmental work, by really taking on and following everything and actually, you know, asking when something wasn't working, you know, I wasn't involved, but she thought she knew who the founder was. She emailed me and asked me one or two questions about the essence of the program, and I answered them. By doing all that, she's landed herself an excellent position post-law school. And she is given back in leadership in her own area. And she ended up on the executive also of the Federation of Canadian Asian Lawyers, their student representative for Ontario. So, I mean, her, that leadership success, and it was like, I met her via conference call when she had just finished her first year, and she's very quiet. None of that was there. It was there, but by giving it a platform and clarity and a community. And I asked her afterwards, because she asked for a letter of recommendation. And so we're talking. I said, you know, I asked her what worked, what didn't, that kind of thing, because I'm always looking to improve something. You know, I said, well, how did you deal with the stresses? Because you had, you know, you had law school stresses. You had leadership stresses. It wasn't easy. That, and you stepped into, you know, the earlier person that she took over from was not as productive and as successful as she was in meeting the needs of the community. And she goes, you know, I just did it. And but she also said that the way it's structured, she never felt alone. And so that's a key. I think a key in building these mentorship kind of communities or any kind of community, part of your architecture is if you want it to be more circular in design, more self-perpetuating, the leadership has to be shared.
Absolutely.
So it can't be more of a pyramid, as you're saying, because that goes back to the old model. Yeah. And that's where my formatting of mentorship programs were specific for this specific situation. And in general, I look to it as being a way to spread the leadership, spread the burden, but it also spreads the engagement. And I truly feel personally, this is just a personal philosophy, I feel that when you ask too little of people, they will give you the bare minimum. And I truly, and I found that, and I based that on my my personal history. I just was one of those people. I had, you know, I was not born wealthy. My parents are immigrants to Canada. We were definitely not upper class or middle class. We were barely making that first level of middle class. And I just took every opportunity. And I would always ask someone like their advice. I probably was a very odd child as a result, but. I probably was, but I also said yes to a lot of opportunity. And I think because I wasn't afraid to fail, doesn't mean I wasn't afraid to fail, like every human is like, of course I was, but there are certain areas in my life I was like, well, if I didn't do really well on that, it's not going to be the end of the world. And I think that's because, you know, my parents were refugees and you kind of like hear the stories at the dinner table about not having food and not having things and learning how to overcome real tragedy. So when something doesn't work out for you at school, you can't really say, turn to your parents and say, oh, well, you know, this didn't work out. They'll say, well, let me tell you about the time we had no food. So it kind of puts things into an odd perspective and you become more resilient as a result.
Absolutely.
But that's, you have to build that in too. Like there's kind of, and one of the failures that of, I think most of these programs have, when we try to look at, and I think that's what I find a lot of people attack millennials and talk about the demographic of millennials, which is a huge demographic. It's like, it's a huge, it's 20 some years of people. It really is. I mean, the youngest millennial is what, 18, and the oldest is like 36. Like that's a huge, very demographic. And I think it's unfair to lump individuals born in that time period all together. But one of the things I love about what the quote-unquote millennials are doing, is how they do question things and disrupt things. And that is a huge benefit. It causes me to think about things differently. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because you have to build sort of like disruption into your community too. You know, we started with the talk about the pyramid and then circle. I sort of think with a circular design, it can handle disruption by opening up the circle and then including it. Whereas a pyramid, okay, well, where would we put that? Where would we put, like, how would the pyramid, what angle of the pyramid would have to change? And if the angle of the pyramid has to change or the base has to widen, is it still a pyramid? So, or if we have to add it at the top, like, you know, using the example of the pyramid you gave, it can't necessarily move with the disruption. And there's one thing about the design being circular, which I'm, you know, I wasn't sure anybody else would ever notice that most of what I do is along those lines, but it you can open it up and include it. To me, that is on a molecular level, it can open up and it can close. It has to have an organic level to it.
More natural too.
Yeah. And
organic.
Yeah. Natural, organic. And I'm a very fact-based business type of person. And so when people hear organic coming from my mouth, they're like, what? There's a reason it actually is in our vernacular. It's because things that are organic are living, they're breathable, they move, there's a pliability. And when you're making a mentorship community, since that's what we're talking about, community architecture, mentorship community specifically is what we've been talking about. If you don't plan for it to be organic, you're not planning it for it to succeed. That doesn't mean it's always going to be like the best shape, but how can it weather the disruptions? How can it figure when to include disruption, right? And so, you know, and how can it allow for the people who are in that circle to grow too? Because it's organic, it allows for expansion and contraction. And at one time, looking back to that particular program and that particular thought experiment, that program had contracted substantially. And was and I was really sitting and watching it thinking, you know, and I was letting it go the way, I didn't interrupt it too much. I was letting it go the way it went for a little while because it's hoping to see if it course corrected. And it did. It actually did. It was like, I was really worried there. I was like, oh, goodness, this is contracted to such a point. I don't know if it'll be functional. I know if it'll be able to expand and breathe again. And I thought it was going to be definitely on life support. And it seemed like that. And it was very painful as, you know, when you found something and you create something, even though you release it and other people take it on and develop it, like run with it. And that's why you do it. There's a little part of you in it and you're kind of looking, oh, it's going to work out. So when I was looking at it, I was like, okay, this is exceptionally painful. And it was, but I watched it and I learned from it. And then sure enough, it started to expand again. And I spent a lot of time, it was a couple of years ago, and I spent a few years trying to really grapple with what worked, what didn't, how come it did, how come it didn't. And I came back to there needing to be more clarity in how the information is disseminated. So when asked, I went back to the original blueprint, and I took out all the things that others had tried to, you know, graft onto it, that were not at all in keeping with the essence of the program. That's sometimes the, when you're founding, because I was still involved at that point, when you're a founder, when you're developing a community as one of those founding leaders or those co-leaders, one of the great things is, and in my case, I was founder. There wasn't a co-founder, it was just founder. I was able to have the authority to go back there. But I was only given the authority to go back there as if the community lets you take out all the things that had been grafted on and all the strange kind of things that weren't in essence and actually weren't on keeping or remotely part of the program, rip it out and clean it up and get it back to its actual shape. And when that happened, I wasn't sure if it would succeed. And sure enough, and that was about 4 years ago. And so, yeah, it's roughly 4 years ago. And so now watching it from that contraction and that cleanup process, it's expanding. And I have the luxury of watching it from the distance too, which makes it interesting. And as a result, you know, some other individuals in different parts of the legal community have been talking to me about meeting communities that are at risk are in the legal area, or those communities that are underrepresented in the profession. And I should mention, I am not a lawyer. I have a law degree, but I'm not a lawyer. I understand the business of it, but going, you know, I've been approached to provide advice for developing communities with persons with disabilities, which are underrepresented in the law. It's not like there aren't lawyers with disabilities. And this is at the law school. This is at coming after law school. They've already graduated and they've been called to the bar and they're full-fledged lawyers. But the difficulty is they're having difficulties establishing themselves in the legal field at any level. And it's very disappointing to see. And so I was approached by someone who wants to develop some sort of community. And we sat down, and it was the concept of mentorship community. When I was talking to her, I said, no, that's not a community you need. You've got that already. It's like, what you need is a different type of community because your objectives are different. And, you know, a while back in our conversation, we were talking about, you know, those three user experiences.
What for? And
goes back to your why.
How?
What is your objective? What is your why? Because that's when I know mentorship is one of those things. I see them pop up all the time. And then I read articles or hear about how they've been a failure, or I hear about people enrolled in those mentorship programs and I hear what their failure. And the question is why? And it's because quite often, and I speak to what we do in my profession, public relations, communications, we build programs. And part of building those programs are to meet a community interest. Well, sometimes sometimes depending on who the organization is, their interest is not necessarily to meet the community interest. Their interest is to appear like they're meeting the community interest. And as public relations professionals, communicators, you try to tell your client or your organization or who you're working for that is not the best way to do things. But that doesn't mean that you win all the time. And so I find that the programs that are put in place to appear like you are doing something, and mentorship seems like one of those easy things because it allows you to retain a sense of control, top down, doesn't allow you to create a community that could, you know, rival what you have. And that's the other thing about community architecture. You have to be attuned to its communities within a larger community. And that's a different conversation about co-community building. And that is a totally different topic. But co-community building is, it's really just like being a good neighbor in some way. Or figuring, it's a lot like dealing with co-branding too. In corporate branding, when you have two different brands that have to work on a product together. You might be under the same company, but they're two different brands with two different brand personalities, and you have to figure out to harness the best and how they can work together. And same thing with co-community building. I think one of the things that, you know, I touched on what I find so great about millennials is how they're disrupting patterns of the way things have been done. And I think that's great. But not direct, it has to be disruption for the sake of betterment. Disruption for the sake of disruption. I think we've all seen there's many examples globally of disruption for the sake of the disruption, and it doesn't necessarily yield a positive result. And I know a lot of people who believe in this disruption for the sake of disruption are like to tout the concept of creative chaos, or basically generating business or generating profitability of a community. And by profitability, I don't necessarily mean money, by destroying something. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, I do know that is the common model, because that's the only way we look at the model. And one thing I really like to see, and I've seen a lot of, the more I watch, especially a lot of the entrepreneurs in their app building and online community building, is they're really looking at building communities differently, and not for destruction, but for a concept of betterment. And it's really a concept of community if you look at it. And I don't think enough has been discussed about that. And that is really a generational shift, in all honesty. And it is very disruptive, but it's a positive disruption versus the negative disruption for the sake of disruption is not necessarily a good thing. As I was saying, when I was talking about millennials, that's one of the things that I think they're really good. And millennials seem to have a clearer concept of community. It's a more of an organic concept of community. And so
how would you describe that?
Well, I look at what they try, like the reality is the program I created for at the University of Ottawa, Faculty of Common Law, that I piloted there and they currently run, is targeted fully for millennials. I think the reason they have a more organic vision is because I find the way they relate to each other, and I do know a lot of, I've read a lot of articles recently in the newspapers about how it's all bad, but because they multitask in an unusual way, not just with their smartphone, they're texting, but they're on their computer and they're doing other things. They have to be, and it's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's a focusing problem. It's a whole bunch of problems, but no one's looking at the upside of that. They have to be like a sort of liquid, able to move quickly from one thing to another. And there is a benefit to that when it's harnessed correctly. And but it's also organic in the sense that it's not on a regimented system. I will look at my text for exactly 5 minutes a second while Facebook is popping up on my computer for this. Now, I come from a generation where, you know, our parents complained when we listened to music while doing homework. And maybe the TV was on. So, you know, and then when computers came, it was even worse. Then it's like, you're in front of the computer and the music's on. And so, you know, every generation complains about the next generation. And that's when they started worrying about Generation X people our parents weren't baby boomers, but the parents were worrying about my generation, us Gen Xers, and our divided attention span. They didn't see the benefits of that. And because millennials have so much information, way more information than any other generation before them, bombarding them, their ability to synthesize it and deal with it. And we're not going to bring up quality because that's a different issue, the quality of the information, but the ability to deal with it, synthesize it, and react to it has to be kind of organic. An individual can make a regimented schedule for themselves, but even that, you know, itself could be argued as being organic. But they have a very organic approach to things. Like, for instance, if you look at a lot of cooperatives in Brooklyn and in Berlin, a lot of the businesses started up as co-ops. And I'm thinking in several places, a lot of coffee houses in Brooklyn were now coffee houses. WeWork is an example of a business that started off with a very much a collaborative and now is more collaborative workspaces. You just have to go to any city, type in collaborative workspace, and you will see tons of little startups coming out of collaborative workspaces. And this is something, is a really good example of organic.
It is within communities.
And there's a functional business. So collaborative workspaces was not something of the Gen X generation. I mean, it started to toward the end when there was an economic, you know, dot-com bust. And then sheer need to, like, share space helped, right? But you look at how even large companies like Google, they have a Google Colab, I believe, is it? Many of the tech companies.
All the campuses.
On their campuses also. They have a Colab building too. And so the design, the actual old school community architecture, which is like a 1970s term, which was specifically about the building, the landscape, the actual building, the architecture, is influenced by that. And it's a reciprocal relationship. Like in most of the tech companies are in these collaborative environments. And I do know there are a lot of people, and it's a very much a generational issue, unfortunately, that view those collaborative spaces as not a positive. They want walls back. They want this. I think they're fantastic. It requires a certain level of skill to tune things out. which is only something you can learn over time. And so an excellent example is the WeWork collaborative space, the brand in the space. But as I said, internationally and around the world, there are more and more of these collaborative spaces. And what's happening is people are finding ways to start other communities within their community. And they're finding it either for profitable business purposes or they're providing it community activist purposes too.
Yeah. I wonder when our political system is going to also mimic that model.
that's a huge question. In some ways it has. And you know, if you look through, every country has such a different system. I mean, Canada has a very different system from, you know, Spain, a very different system from the United States for sure. Different system from Germany. But I think you are seeing more and more of this. And I think let's take a good example. Everybody knows who's read the news, whether it be on Facebook or whether it be on Twitter or whether it be in an old school newspaper on a digital platform. The Women's March in January, what is that, January 2017, when the Women's March happened after President Trump's inauguration, that was a very organic, one of the best examples of organic political action I've ever seen. It became very organic. It was a call to action put out on Facebook. Someone took it up. Groups populated through community groups online first. The Women's March had its own app. By then it blossomed, and not only was there a Women's March in Washington, D.C., but there were numerous marches around the country.
Yes.
And around the world. And it didn't just stay in North America. It spread. And to this day, the Women's March has its own, you know, it's called Women's March. And then there's basically the only way to describe it is sub-communities. There's Women's March Canada. There's Women's March, you know, America. There's Women's March Great Britain. There's Women's March. And they all function under the brand, but they also do their own forms of political action. And that's very organic. There's online action, in-person action. I do know in Canada, it certainly has been, you know, the issues are very different that they tackle. The essence and the belief system under which they are, the bigger umbrella, is the same. So that would be an example of an organic situation that we see. But once again, it's very disruptive, isn't it? Because that's like your question is, when will our political systems or organizations and it goes back to how are the systems developed? In the case of, and these are the institutional barriers that most people identify. And the majority of people want to see change, but it really comes back to how will they change? And I think in the case of, as you're identifying, communities, political systems, political community, it would change when it depends on its structure. I think if a community is a resilient political community, will be able to open itself up and be organic and adopt it. And that comes down to political party system. And that's where it starts, because that's how it's a very grassroots thing, and very much so. And you're starting to see it. This United States is an excellent, laboratory for all this. Think of, if you want to just remove yourself from any political feeling about the situation, what's going on in the United States is very in flux. It's very heightened. It's very emotional because there's so much at stake. But you have disruption from all sides. From all sides of the political spectrum. How the actual structure, the political structure, the way it's set up under their system, their Congress and their you know, President of the United States, how the executive and the judicial and all the branches will work together. And it's interesting that there are three parts actually in there too, in the governance body. How they will be able to absorb all that and respond will be the question. And no one will know until it's over. And that's the experiment of democracy, right? Not to sound a little too weird, but whether it can. And I have great hopes for the democratic experiment because Canada's democracy and we have a very different form of government. We have a constitutional monarchy, But we too have these kinds of disruptions. But how they were resilient goes to the
I guess
level.
This is all making me think about still our democracy is still a pyramid and it still needs to change. And I envisioned the future democracy not with one leader, but at least cooperation leadership, where two or three people can represent the whole country instead of just one single figure. And that those three figures, those two or three figures, had to collaborate and come to a middle ground and to a middle point to find a benefit and outcome for the whole country and not for themselves. Because when the problem with hierarchical structures and pyramidal structures is that at the end, the people, we are humans. And when you see yourself in power and you see yourself, how comfortable is to be on the top, then you become afraid of going back at the bottom and dealing again with all those difficulties and issues that people from the bottom have to deal with. So by removing that individual from the top, I guess you can reduce the possibilities of...
Well, I don't know. I think this is where I disagree a bit. Because a democracy, more or less, I guess the definition of democracy, and I guess people can Google it and find out. They're listening at home. They are yelling at the podcast. basically, as I recall, a democracy is just a system of government of the whole citizenry, where all members of the state, all citizenship, are eligible to participate. The question is, who's considered eligible? Probably is the problem. But it's a democracy in and of itself is our citizens who form a whole governing body. Theoretically. And they vote directly on each issue. Theoretically. Now that's all theoretical definitions from what I recall. And I know I did not say it cleanly, but poli-sci is not one of the degrees I did have. So I'm sure people can yell at the and make comments to the podcast all they want. But one of the things about democracy and the concept of government by the people, it really puts the onus on the people. So when you see, and we have this problem in Canada, and, you know, it was seen most recently in the last election in the United States, and it's not just in Canada, and it's not just in North America, it's around the world, the low participation of individuals in their actual elections to vote, or participating by actually going to their local town council, because what we often think is of democracy and government in big, writ large, national. But the reality is, for the majority of us people, us regular people, the issues of day-to-day politics are, do I have running water? Do I have electricity? Is my garbage picked up? These are civic or local politics, local level politics. Most people don't even go put their name forth. Most people don't go and attend those town council meetings, and everybody's like, well, we don't have time. So it goes back to the engagement. The theory of democracy, of government by the people, is fantastic. And it goes back to how do you then design to allow them to be most involved. And I think that's what's evolving, hopefully that is what is evolving. Because I do believe democracy, compared to all other forms of government, is the best that we've got. It's not perfect. It's incredibly flawed. But it's better than the alternative, which is an authoritarian regime or totalitarian regime. That's my opinion. I'm not one for an authoritarian state, because that in and of itself is problematic for not just human rights issues, but many other issues. But when you said you change the person at the top, I think you have to change the people at the bottom. The reality is, when you develop a community, and the examples we've been discussing, the Women's Mentorship Program, I didn't seek to change the top, because that's too big of an issue. I sought to include more people in the bottom, give them more information, and hopefully they will realize change in a transformative personal way. and in turn transform, in particular in the case of lawyers, they have a way of transforming and cutting across every part of our society. And for the most part, from the, you know, because I do track, you know, see what's going on, because it is a thought experiment and it's still an experiment. So far, so good. But only time will tell whether it had massive change. And there needs to be, as I said, only close to 1,000 women have gone through it. So I need, you need a critical mass, too. You actually need a certain threshold before you can see transformative change. The only way you can change the people at the top is to help the bottom rise and maybe change how the bottom is engaging with the top. Because you're right. Most of our political institutions, including democratic institutions, are incredibly top-down. They're very hierarchical. And that's a historical reason, and that's an institutional barrier and an institutional reason. But let's say you change the person at the top. What happens if you didn't change the middle and the bottom? How long is that person who's transformative going to be able to stay at the top, right? Mm-hmm. So in order to change a system, there's a lot of wisdom, and this is where, you know, in people who've come before, and we've seen transformative changes in society where people have gotten together and changed from the bottom up. And to be quite frank, someone like President Barack Obama, to see an African-American male become president of the United States was a transformative thing for the rest of, for the entire world. You know, Canada, we live next door to the United States, and that's something I don't think, based on the rhetoric becoming, that I would have actually ever saw in my lifetime, but it happened. So hopefully it'll happen for women too and other people, because you need to sell, and what you say is very apt. If you can't see yourself in that power structure, if you can't see yourself in that pyramid, it's hard to imagine engaging with it, right? It's hard to imagine changing it, but there's only one way to do that, is by engaging with it. And it comes back to, you know, community. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating to watch in the community architecture discussion that we're having, and as it relates now to politics, is how will the architecture change? How will it be renovated, since we're dealing with that architectural thematic there? Mm-hmm. How will our current existing formats for political structure change? And I think the only way to change it substantively is by a steady growth and engagement and building of communities that can be organic, that can expand and contract, because that's the one thing about politics. You know, you can't ever say, it's lovely to be able to say it is X all the time. But the reality is, you cannot. The majority of politics, well, when you're politically campaigning, are black and white, because that's what sells and division actually works. The reality is, you need to govern in the gray. you cannot afford to be black and white. Not because it's a failure of following through, but because the reality is, the majority of people, the majority of community, we don't live on an extreme. We live in the middle, where it's all gray. And that requires a certain organic. And so I take your point, but I disagree. I think you need to change the bottom. You need to build a different structure. The only way you're going to change that structure is by helping elevate more people, so they can start, you know, hammering away and renovating. And I think one of the ways you do that is by creating alternate communities that seek not to topple, but seek to rebuild.
Well, thank you, Charlotte. It has been a real nice conversation. I think we have a lot of things to think about. And I would love to invite people to share their thoughts on the comments on the website of the podcast. I really appreciate your time that you've given us. I hope our listeners enjoyed the conversation, and hope to see you soon.
Well, thank you, Sarah, so much for the opportunity. It's been really great. You've given me a lot to think about. and I appreciate the opportunity about, you know, philosophies and thoughts and experiences. It's really given me a lot to think about. I really hope your listeners will enjoy it, and I look forward to them to connecting with me. And once again, thank you so much.
If you want to keep the conversation with Charlotte, you can find her on Twitter under her name, Charlotte Walters. She also has a website where you can find more information about her Feminist Mentorship Cut project and the work she does. Now, I will give the turn to Ted so he can introduce a few pretty big profiles. Thank you for listening.
All right. Well, first off, a big thanks to Sarah for putting together this great interview with Charlotte Walters over the past couple episodes. It is our first two-part episode, something we've been experimenting with. And if you were following along from episode 16 and now into 17, there's just so much interesting information there and insight and perspective that we didn't want to have to do all those kind of ruthless edits and, you know, cut out as much as possible, so we decided to keep it in, keeping this one a little bit shorter, but certainly having that, it's nice to have that extra time to hear what Charlotte has to say. I was, one thing that triggered my mind listening to the first little bit of this episode there, talking about the circles and the triangles and the kind of organizational structures, and it made me think about how we do this podcast here, because you know, it's been such a group effort and everybody's stepping up and kind of taking turns. And as much as I myself may kind of, you know, just make sure things are falling into place and that it is, we have a plan, let's say, for the next episode, for the next couple of weeks, it's a very organic and kind of spontaneous and genuine effort here that we say, who's going to take on the next episode? Who wants to do what? And it comes together. And all that being said, it doesn't just happen completely naturally. You have to have the willingness to share the workload and to kind of step up and do the next episode, let's say. And as I say, that's exactly what Sarah has done over the last couple of weeks here. So it's been a really interesting experiment in a group project, which I think is something that we can do even more of in the Putty tribe with lots of people who, of course, have lots of busy lives and things that they're doing. But, you know, we can share these projects and we can kind of each take our turns and whatever it may be in getting things done and doing things that are fun and interesting, but where it doesn't always fall on, say, one or two person's shoulders. So this has been a really good experiment with that. And listening to that conversation triggered my mind in thinking about how things like this can be organized and in that organic way, of course, that we were talking about as well. And before we wrap up with Charlotte, just a quick reminder of how you can reach her and learn more about what she's doing. You heard quite a bit about her various business ventures and courses and projects and things she's put together. So, of course, she does have her website. It's charlottewalters.com. So charlottewalters.com, all one word, charlottewalters.com. And same thing, Charlotte Walters on Twitter. You can find her there as well. So if you are certainly interested in some of the things she has to offer, then that's the way you can find her and give her some great feedback. So thanks again to Charlotte for being on the show here the last couple episodes, and thanks again to Sarah for putting all that together. So I'd like to turn some attention back to our Putty Peep profiles, which we didn't get to last time. You know, it was a bit of a longer episode, and we didn't want to take up too much of your time, but it is really nice and fun to profile as many people as we can within the group. So I'd like to turn our attention to Europe, where we have a couple Putty Peep profiles to share with you this time. First of all is Friederike, who is from southern Germany. She is currently into gardening, motorcycles, cats, reading and watching all the things, okay, and co-owning our Nature Lovers group in the Putty Tribe. Where she's lived, she says, different cities in South Germany and a couple months in Dublin. You can see what she's up to on Instagram. Her account name is terraced_garden. Terraced, T-E-R-R-A-C-E-D, _garden on Instagram.com. She talks about her current learning goals. She says, creating a lifestyle that integrates my multi-potentiality and external necessities like paying the mortgage, paying the bills, things like that. That would be something to follow up on a little bit more. And, you know, as so much of us, so many of us can relate to in juggling these different projects and even careers, of course, and different jobs. And, you know, how do you integrate that instinct for multipotentiality with obviously the necessity of having to pay the bills and earn a living? And so that's where her mind is at these days. And then we go over to near Paris, France, and we have Pierre de Vessian, who is currently into exploring coaching, investing, building websites, and being super helpful in the forum. Pierre is a real language file. He says he's lived in Spain and Germany while growing up, so he's fluent in French, of course, and also Spanish and German. And he says he's getting to the fluent level in English, but he also speaks bits of Italian, Portuguese, Mandarin, Russian, Arabic, and even Welsh. That's pretty neat. You can follow him on Twitter. It's name is P-V-E-S-I-A-N. P-V-E-S-I-A-N is his Twitter profile. You can check him out there. And Pierre talks about how his main struggles as a multipod are trying not to get overwhelmed by all the daily updates and news and all the things he's currently interested in, which is quite a massive list. Trying to figure out how to make a business out of all of these passions. And, of course, not appearing as a crazy person to colleagues, friends, and families. Well, I'll try to give you a short snippet here of some of the things he's interested in. He talks about he loves science, he loves history and movies and books and TV shows and rewatching TV shows and food and the stock markets and reading and military strategy and geopolitics and sci-fi and philosophy and spiritualism and making money and driving boats and teaching and cryptocurrencies. Pierre's a fascinating guy. Let's try to get to know him a bit better. And great to see him as profiled as the latest Putty P profile of the week. So I had the pleasure of seeing Sandrine just last week in person. She came by to visit me in Ottawa, where I work. Of course, Sandrine lives in Montreal, and it's only a couple hours or so away from Ottawa. We had met actually once before in person. I was in Montreal in April, and that's where we met for the first time face-to-face after a few months of working on the show here together. But so this time, vice versa, she was in Ottawa with her son and her mother actually as well. And so we got to chat for a bit and, you know, kind of throwing around some ideas about the show and things to look forward to. We've both had super busy summers and she's been putting on in the hours getting her pilot's license to launch her business that you heard about a few episodes back. And now's the time she has to do it, basically, when she can get up in the air, when the temperature is all right and the timing works out. So she's been super busy, and I've been working pretty flat out with my job. But things start to kind of settle down here as we get into September. And we're both excited to get back into doing some more podcasting. In the meantime, of course, as always, thanks to Sarah, and thanks to our other guest hosts. You heard Clay not too long ago. You'll hear Vanessa coming up again soon. She's working on an episode. There's always Mike there in the background working on our show notes, which are wonderful. And, of course, Joel for lots of technical and emotional support and keeping us inspired to keep this thing going. So it's been a fun project. Here we are. We're 8 months in and heading up towards episode 20. You can always send us ideas, of course, as we say every episode. We love to hear some feedback, suggestions on topics we can cover. You can reach us at themultipodcast@gmail.com, all one word, and send us a message. Let us know what you think and if you have any ideas. Or, of course, if you'd like to be on the show. So let us know, and we'll be back again in a couple of weeks. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Take care.